6. We lost in New Hampshire, but not badly. It rained election day, and that was good for us. Stanton voters proved to be as devoted to the candidate as he had been to them. In fact, according to the exit polls, an implausible number said the deciding factor was that they'd actually met the governor. And so we did somewhat better than Richard's 1 in 4. Our 29% was more than Nielsen and Martin combined. Harris won, of course. He could manage no more than 38% in his home state, which gave us hope. Election day itself was strange, empty. We slept in. We packed our bags. We went to the movies. We saw Wayne's World. Daisy and I held hands. Richard jiggled. Lucille, an unexpected delight, had a rowdy, infectious laugh. Halfway through the movie, I went out into the lobby and called Brad Lieberman. The first wave of exit polling was coming in. "We're alive," he said. I went back in, whispered the results to Daisy on my left and Richard on my right. Daisy squeezed my hand and stuck her nose in my ear. "No Caribbean this week," she whispered.
"Disappointed?"
"Yes and no." We shared an umbrella walking back across the asphalt expanse to the Hampton Inn. We walked with our arms around each other, very close and comfortable. Richard and Lucille went ahead, separately, their black umbrellas bobbing in the wind. Mountains of snow were stacked around the light poles. Everything was gray and white. "I'm beginning to feel nostalgic," I said. "We've lived our lives around this parking lot. I can't count the number of times I looked out over at the multiplex and wished I was at the movies. And I can't remember them ever having a Werner Herzog," Daisy teased. "And all the nights I had to slog across over there and retrieve the candidate from Danny's Dunkin' Donuts. You wonder what Danny's going to do with himself now." "I wonder what the candidate's going to do with himself now," she said, "without Danny's Dunkin' Donuts." We stopped just outside the lobby door, under the marquee, but still under the umbrella, and turned to each other and kissed. It was a serious kiss, our first public display of affection. "Henry," she said, meaning, "did that mean what I think it meant?"
"Yes," I said, "it did."
She looked at me, her eyes widened. She put her hand on my cheek. "What are we going to have him say tonight?" she asked.
"That it was a moral victory."
"Henry," I looked at her, "do you think the telethon helped us any?"
"No," I said. "He did it by sheer force of will. He did it on Saturday, standing at the mall all day. He did it on Sunday and Monday. I mean, have you ever seen anybody do one-on-one like that? But the telethon wasn't a bad idea," I added quickly, remembering that it had been hers.
"Henry," she said, "is this?"
"I think so."
"Or are we just relieved that we won?"
"We didn't win."
"We didn't die," she said, "so we won."
"We better go inside."
She kissed me again, quickly, open-mouthed, on the lips.
Jack and Susan were both up in the suite working the phones, thanking local supporters. "I will never forget this," Jack said over and over. "I will always remember what you did for us here."
Susan hugged me. It was a big day for hugs.
Jack was off the phone now. He came over and shook my hand. He was wearing a white shirt, suit pants, no shoes.
"Henry, I'll admit it. Last night, I thought we were dead."
"Well, Leon's last track didn't help much," I said.
"He couldn't measure intensity," he said. "Our folks just felt more strongly about this election."
"That's because of you, sir."
The governor ambled over to the table. There was a fruit platter and some sandwiches.
"Don't," Susan said.
"You fell off the wall, you didn't crack, but you're still looking like Humpty Dumpty." She said this lightly, but with an edge. He narrowed his eyes and took some grapes.
"Henry, how early can we get on and off and go home?" he asked.
"Polls close at 8, I said. "You've got to stay and do the nets. You want to do Nightline?"
"No," Susan said. "And no press conference. Those jerks had us buried, all of them. Let them stew in it."
"Well, We aren't going to be able to make them disappear, Stanton said.
They weren't able to make you disappear either, she said. And so they'll have to come to terms with that. We're going to tighten this thing up now, Henry. We've got a new set of priorities. We'll do local TVs first, network second, local pencils third, national pencils last.
And the pundits never? Stanton laughed. Come on, they're there. We can pick and choose. Henry, get Richard and Daisy and I'll get them here about 6. We'll thrash this out. Also, have Lorraine schedule the nets. We'll do them all tonight. We'll do the morning shows from Mammoth Falls tomorrow, from the mansion, okay? He looked over at Susan. She nodded. And okay, Mrs. Stanton, no press conference. Henry, y'all come on the plane with us. Tell Richard and Arlen and Leon and whoever else we got here to stick around and work spin. Then get themselves down to Mammoth Falls by tomorrow night. You know, I'm gonna miss this place.
So many wonderful things happened to your reputation here, she said.
No, really, he said. It was okay. It was a rite of passage. You realize how amazing these folks are, voting for me after all this shit? There was a time last night, it was getting on toward 10 o'clock, and I was working, my 8th restaurant, table to table, and I knew most of these damn people wouldn't be voting for me. Hell, half of them wouldn't be voting, period. And I came to this table, 2 couples about our age, teachers, lawyers, something like that, having dessert, getting ready to split the bill. Back home, the kind of folks that would have been friends of ours. Up here, they're going to be voting Harris without even thinking about it. One of the women teaches preschool. She asks about Head Start. And you know, we just start talking about it. I forget we were in a campaign. Damn near sat down and had a cup of coffee with him. She was smart. You could tell she was good at what she did. And I told her about some of the things we'd been messing with down home.
Tish Miller's thing? Susan said.
Yeah, Stanton said, moving over to the wing chair where Susan was sitting, leaning down, putting his hands on her shoulders, staring her in the eye. Tish Miller's one of mine. Inspirational model, right, sweetheart?
Okay, okay.
Anyhow, this woman says to me, Governor, from all I've heard and read during this campaign, I'd never guessed you knew or cared about this stuff.
I wonder why, Susan said.
No, it's not just them, not just the Scorps, he said. It's us, it's me. We gotta figure out how to communicate what we love about what we do. We gotta show them we're doing this not for ambition or glory.
Not just, Susan said, but softer. She was with him now.
Not just, not only, but because we love doing for the folks, finding things that work. We gotta think about how we can do that, right, Henry? Because, you know what? I would be willing to bet you anything. I got that woman's vote today.
Now all you have to do, Susan said, is personally meet and greet the other 250 million Americans.
Fine with me, Jack Stanton said. But first, I won't go home. Home. We landed in deep night. There was no moon. There was, however, a soft breeze coming up from the gulf, carrying with it a moist hint of spring.
I stood by the river for a moment before going up to my apartment.
The river seemed familiar, an old acquaintance. It flowed quickly, silently, as if it were a well-oiled piece of machinery doing its job. My apartment was less familiar. I hadn't slept there in a week, but it seemed much longer. The place felt dusty, moldy. Several of the plants along the river window had died. I turned on the television. CNN was telling it our way. We were alive, and Lawrence Harris was breathing more life in us yet. His soundbite was pompous, trite. The people of New Hampshire have sent the message that they are ready for fiscally responsible governance, he said, without a hint of a smile. I expect the rest of the American people we'll respond favorably to the message as we move along. Then the clincher. I think we are growing up as a nation.
Lovely. I opened the refrigerator and winced. Something had gone bad. This presented me with several decisions. Clean the fridge or let it fester. A Perrier or that lone bottle of Heineken. Fester, Heineken.
My own personal victory party. I lay down on the bed, watched CNN some more. It was pundit time. Several Washington scorps were talking about the weak Democratic field and who would save it. Ozio's non-write-in campaign had fizzled in New Hampshire. They showed a clip of the governor of New York rushing into or out of a building. He seemed perturbed.
I never asked for it. I never encouraged it, he said. So why should I comment on it?
And so the anchor wondered, if not Ozio, who? Larkin? Someone was saying very definitely that Larkin would soon jump in.
I don't know anything, I told the television and shut it off.
I noticed the collection of Alice Munro stories I'd bought a month earlier splayed open on the coffee table across the room. Had I left it like that? Cruel and unusual punishment for a book. I hate broken spines. I was willing to endure personal discomfort to maintain the integrity of a spine. It seemed a long way to go, but I got up and walked across the room. The book had been left open to a story called Barden Bus. I began to read the first paragraph in the half-light. It was bold and yet wistful. Perfect. I snapped on the reading light, lay down lengthwise on the couch facing the river, and read myself to sleep there. Jack Stanton woke me up in the morning, banging on the door.
Henry, Henry, rise and shine.
He was wearing a yellow knit shirt, leather jacket, jeans, and cowboy boots. It was 8 o'clock.
Geez, you look a sight, he said. Fall asleep in your clothes, huh? Didn't watch me all fresh and confident on the morning shows? Well, get on up. We're going for a drive going down to Grace Junction. Hey, look, I even brought you breakfast. A banana, an apple, black coffee, all your favorites.
Why Grace Junction?
Dunno, take a drive, see some country, see Mama. Come on, Henry. Get yourself showered and shaved. I'll just sit here, read the paper, make some calls.
The Bronco was downstairs, Uncle Charlie lounging in the back. I rode shotgun. The governor drove and sang. He had the radio turned way up. He sang tentatively on the new songs, more confidently on the oldies. He turned the radio down when Achy Breaky Heart, which was just gathering steam about then, came on.
I hate that goddamn song, he said. I have always hated gimmick songs, even when I was a kid. Purple People Eater, and How Much Is That Doggy in the Window? Singing Nun? People should have more respect for the music than that, you know? It's like politics. You should always have respect for what you're doing, respect the ceremonies and rituals, respect the audience.
He was certainly feeling chipper. He drove south on the interstate about 30 miles, sticking right on the speed limit, then turned west on a 2-lane state road toward Grace Junction. It was an uncomfortable sort of day. The sun was warm, but the air was cold. The wind had shifted around north and carried with it memories of New Hampshire. The governor couldn't find the right mix. He lowered the windows, and it got cold. He raised the windows, and it got stuffy. When he lowered the windows just a little, the whistling made it hard to hear the music.
Henry, he said, snapping off the radio and lowering the windows about 10 miles out from Grace Junction. I'm going to go over to Doc Hastings, get some blood pooled. I think it's about time we dealt with the McAllister situation.
I had been dreading this moment. Fat Willie had been there in New Hampshire, in the back of my mind. He would blindside me whenever I began to feel optimistic. When there was no cause for optimism, the McAllister situation seemed moot, a pragmatic callousness I did not admire in myself. But I never really thought it through. It was just too awful. I never seemed able to fix on it, to analyze it, to make a judgment. Sitting there, beginning to freeze a little in the Bronco, I suddenly realized why. I could not allow myself to believe that Jack Stanton would take advantage of Fat Willie's teenage daughter. And yet, I couldn't believe that he hadn't.
Deal with it? I asked. Tomorrow I want you and Howard to go over there to Fat Willie's and lean on him a little, the governor said. Not really lean on him, but tell him we had to resolve this thing, establish paternity. Tell him we want the girl to have an amniocentesis. Explain what that means in detail. Tell him it's a long needle through the belly button. Tell him to explain that to Loretta. Henry, these aren't sophisticated people. They're good people, but not sophisticated.
I think you present this to them, tell them that I'm insisting on it, that I had my blood pulled already. Chances are the girl will back off her claim.
Why me? I said, shivering.
Is it because I'm...
It's because Willie chose you, he said. I didn't. I can't help it if he can't see past skin color.
Maybe he just thought I'd be sympathetic,
I said, knowing that was only part of the truth. Look, you don't have to say anything. Howard knows what to say, but you should be there since he came to you.
I turned toward the open window. The air was sharp but fresh. It smelled of newly turned soil. We were riding through raw, red clay farmland. It was exotic country. The roadsides were the color of a squeezed fingertip. I remember thinking it must be tough to farm such land.
Governor, I said, if I'm going to do this, there's something I need to know. I am not the father of that child, he said.
Grace Junction was Onawatchie County's seat. It had the requisite domed two-story county court building on the town square and a gray granite Confederate war memorial that was particularly grisly. These, our sons, gave all in glorious struggle. There was a tablet for Civil War dead, two more for World War I and II, and a fourth for Vietnam, which was practically empty, leaving plenty of space for the next war. The governor's father, William H. Stanton, was listed among the World War II dead, though he had never lived in Grace Junction. The square around the court building was half-populated now, law offices and the Willows Funeral Home on the north side, Presley's Drugs and the Florida, the most popular and political cafe in town, on the west. The south had several thrift shops and a gaping hole where Zucker's furniture had once been. The east side had Meyer's Stride Right Shoes, the Modest Values Dress Shop, and more vacant storefronts. Despite the strong sense that time had passed it by, this was a fairly pleasant square, as such places go. The sidewalks were red brick, set in a herringbone pattern. The courthouse was framed by live oaks. Daffodils were blooming now. Spring was coming. The town seemed green, lived in, not stark or defeated, as so many rural towns were. We entered town from the east, through Blacktown, which was mostly shotgun shacks and cinderblock convenience stores, set in a web of train tracks, dilapidated garages, and auto repair shops. The sawmills, mostly closed now, were on the south side of town. White folks lived on the north and west. Rich folks north, rednecks west. Mama lived on the west side, in a tan clapboard house on a double lot. The governor had offered her a new house in Mammoth Falls, a brick house on the north side of Grace Junction. Anything she wanted. But she was a creature of her place and wanted to stay put.
The gals wouldn't know where to come for our Wednesday poker party if I picked up and moved, she said.
Mama was sitting out on the front porch, bundled up in a heavy sweater over her usual State U tracksuit when we pulled up.
Hooray, hurrah, yee-haw,
she said, tugging him down by the neck and planting about an ounce of lipstick on his cheek.
You did it, honey.
Well, I survived, the governor said. By the way, what on earth happened to you? You just took off, never said bye. When you get home, Mama?
I left there on Monday. I should have stayed, I know, but I was just too nervous, biting my fingernails, pacing the floor, practically dripping in my britches. I was intending to stick around, but then I heard a whole bunch of Grace Junction folks was taken out on Monday, so I went with them, Doc Hastings and all.
Going over to see the doc now, Governor said. Henry, Charlie, you guys keep Mama company. We can all meet up at the Florida for lunch.
I'll come with you, Charlie said. Got some business with Jerry Conway over at the county barn. Owes me some money off of New Hampshire. You take odds? Mama asked. No, just straight. $50 on 25%. I did better than that, Mama said. Jackie, you're making your mama a rich old lady.
I get a cut? The governor asked.
I give you 10% on my take in November, she said. Now get out of here. Henry, what's your pleasure? Cup of coffee?
It was an old-fashioned house, a sane person's house. It probably hadn't changed much since the governor was a boy. The living room was on the left, dining room on the right, with the kitchen behind. The dining room had a solid old mahogany table and chairs, with matching sideboard. Good stuff. Mama had come from Gentry. There was a dark green horsehair Chesterfield sofa with antimacassars along the wall in the living room, flanked by a lazy boy and a maple rocker with a crocheted seat cushion, all facing an enormous console television, which seemed the only new piece in the house. There were several oak lamp tables with doilies, a magazine rack next to the lazy boy. Mama subscribed to Time, Good Housekeeping, Sports Illustrated, and the Smithsonian. Shaggy chocolate wall-to-wall carpeting. There was a mirror on the wall behind the sofa, portraits of her parents on the back wall, and a large campaign poster of her son looking very 70s and glamorous running for attorney general over the television. We moved on back to the kitchen, which was light and large, and had more photos. Jack as a boy, Jack as a teenager, Uncle Charlie, other folks I didn't recognize. You have any pictures of Jack's father? I asked.
Over there, she said. There's the two of us in Kansas City.
It was a studio shot. They were holding hands, their heads together. Lovebirds. She wore a lot of makeup back then, too. He had a sort of Ronald Coleman look, dark, slicked back hair, pencil mustache. He was in uniform, a private, first class. The governor, it was clear, looked a lot like his mother. He had her nose and mouth.
So, you did say coffee?
She asked, already pouring me some from a Mr. Coffee.
About losing my mind. Take anything?
No, thanks, just black, I said.
What was he like?
Oh, he's just glorious, she said, sitting down at the gray formica table with chrome legs.
You know the story, right?
I'd heard the story, but I wanted to hear it from her. You met at the USO? I asked.
Yes, sirree, she said. He was a friend of Charlie's. I was up visiting Charlie. He was about to ship out. Kansas City was the place back then. Don't ask me why. But it was just swarming with fellas. And so there I was, and Charlie introduced me to Will Stanton, and he asked me to dance. It was Glenn Miller. Getting sentimental over you. Or was that Dorsey? Anyway, it just clicked. I mean, clicked, like a lock tumbling. You only get a few moments of magic in life, I suspect, and that was mine. He knew it, I knew it. We didn't wait for the formalities, if you know what I mean. But we did get ourselves hitched before we went. Charlie was best man. We had a couple of weeks, long enough for Jackie to get planted. She paused. Was that when you worked at Harry Truman's haberdashery? I asked.
Oh, shit. Who told you that? Jackie? God. Henry. Let me tell you something. Kids will believe anything. Truman's was well bankrupt by the time this girl hit town. I mean, he was vice president of the United States by then, fixing to move on up. People pointed out where his store had been, but it was long gone. I guess I told that to Jackie just to tell him something. He always wanted to know everything there was to know about his daddy, but there wasn't all that much to know. I hadn't known him for 2 weeks. And I can't remember two better weeks in my entire life. Then he left, and he died at Iwo. And he's buried somewhere out there, and his son is going to be president of the United States someday. And Uncle Charlie, did he win the Congressional Medal of Honor? He won some sort of thing. Came home a mess. He laid on that damn couch in the living room, shaking like a leaf and screaming in the night. But I think it was Jackie pulled him out. He was devoted to Jackie, like he was his own. She paused. You know, Uncle Charlie isn't really Uncle Charlie. He's not my brother, not by blood, leastways. Mama and Pops inherited him from Daddy's best friend, Junior Treadwell. Tree fell on Junior. He was a lumberjack back when they were lumbering in these woods. Then Junior's wife, Janetta, got womb cancer and died. My folks took him in. I was a little girl. So Charlie's real name is Treadwell, not Malone. But we was raised brother and sister, and my folks did adopt him. Tough life, I said.
Yeah, it was real, Mama said.
Not like now. Up in New Hampshire, I saw all those folks going around in goose down jackets.
And I was thinking to myself, we didn't have nothing like that at all. We didn't have any insulation, you know? It was just us and life. Accentuate the positive, eliminate the negative, don't mess with mystery in between. People seem to do more things, but take less chances nowadays. You mind if I light up?
Not at all. You were fabulous up there in New Hampshire, I said. You really lifted everyone's spirits, and believe me, that was some heavy lifting.
Oh, I was just running my mouth.
You know, Henry, she said, lowering her voice.
We used to have separate drinking fountains here in Grace Junction. A lot of us weren't too proud of that, but we didn't say nothing till Jackie started eating over at the Florida.
The Florida?
Yeah, no kidding. That was Mabel Brockett's place over in Blacktown before she got big and moved to downtown. That was Jackie's doing, if you want to know the truth. He started eating there when he was in high school. You know, they were having the sit-ins about that time over in Nashville, and Jackie wanted to do something, so he sat in at Mabel's, though no one noticed it or gave two shits, a white boy sitting in Blacktown. Can you imagine? But he knew what he was doing. Mabel was the best damn cook in the Piney Woods, and Jackie began talking her up in school, you know? He started doing takeout, taking orders from his classmates, because none of them had the guts to go on over to Blacktown. Anyways, Jackie got this notion. He wants Mabel to cater the senior prom, and it became this big deal. They had an election over it, and that election came to be how Grace Junction argued it out over integration.
The phone rang.
Yeah, we're coming, Mama said. Henry's been talking my ear off. She hung up the phone. Come on, son. Do you ever ride shotgun with a blind old lady behind the wheel?
We took the scenic route into town. She showed me all her friends' houses, the Baptist church where they used to go, the Methodist church where she had her AA meetings, the Assembly of God she went to now.
I'm a Christian, sort of, she said. I don't drink no more, smoke only a little when I'm nervous or feel like I'm going to be nervous. But I asked the Lord to forgive my gambling, and my Lord is a forgiving fellow. He let me cheat on everything but the drinking.
We parked in front of Presley's Drugs, down the block from the Florida.
You hear of Sherman Presley?
Mama said.
That was his daddy's pharmacy. Al Presley was the leading seg in town.
He still run it? I asked.
No, he took a heart attack and died, Mama said. Sherman was long gone, too damn smart to get stuck down here, like Jackie, only mean.
So Ruth Ann, Al's daughter, inherited the store. Her husband, Ralph Winter, runs it.
And how did the Florida move downtown?
Well, this wasn't exactly prime real estate after Walmart's come in, and Mabel had this built-in clientele, all the kids who'd started in on her chicken and ribs in high school, so she took the leap. If you can believe it, it was the one time Jackie and Sherman Presley ever worked together on something.
They both backed her. Sherm, I think, cause he wanted to step away from his daddy's seg ways in people's minds. Jackie, cause he's Jackie.
It wasn't quite noon, but the Florida was nearly full, and the governor was holding court at a round table in the front counter, next to the window. There was a sign on the wall above the table, Jack Stanton's table. There was a big, strange, hand-painted photo of the governor on the wall, which made him look like a corpse, and smaller photos of Jack and Susan eating there, of Jack and Mama and Uncle Charlie, of Jack and a wraith-like black woman who had to be Mabel Brockett.
Is Mabel still around? I asked Mama as we walked in.
No, her daughter Peepsy May running it now. Hey, honey.
How you doing, sweetie pie?
What's up, killer?
Mama was working her way down toward Jack's table, shaking hands and blowing kisses to all comers. The crowd was a mix of courthouse and feed store types. She knew everyone, of course.
Lunch on the house, she shouted. Jack's buying.
Only kidding.
Y'all's ought to buy Jack his meal, given the tourist business gonna be coming through here when he's president of the United States.
So now, Mama, Jack said, standing up, how these folks ain't even gonna vote for me.
I'll swallow my pride and vote for you, said a middle-aged man who had the looks of an insurance or farm equipment salesman.
He wore a short-sleeved white shirt and a pocket protector.
If it means more business. Come on, Joe Bob, Jack said. You ain't voted Democrat since Roosevelt. and it always meant more business, spite what the Republicans say.
There was laughter and applause, and we sat down. Doc Hastings was there, but not Charlie.
Where's your uncle? Mama asked.
Losing his $50 back to Jerry and the boys, the governor said. We'll pick him up on the way out. Doc and me just talking about what comes next. Doc thinks we breeze. I'm not so sure.
You're the class of the field, son, Doc Hastings said. Name the man that can beat you.
I don't know, the governor said. They don't know me. They don't know who I am, and I don't know how to get it across.
Doc Hastings shook his white mane, put his hand on the governor's forearm.
You always figure out a way to get it across, son.
Suddenly, he had tears in his eyes. He stuck a long, slim finger behind his small, round glasses, digging out the moisture. The governor wrapped an arm around the old man's shoulders.
Excuse me, Doc Hastings said to me. I've known this boy too long.
Mom was looking away.
Hey, Petesy,
she shouted.
Can't we get any service over here, or are we second-class customers?
The mansion was smelling of popcorn that night when I arrived for the meeting. I went to the kitchen, where Susan and young Jackie were emptying one bag and sticking another into the microwave. Susan was wearing a Yale sweatshirt and jeans. She had her Coke bottle glasses on. She was sort of rabbity and tired, but not bad, considering all she'd been through.
No more donuts, she said, carrying a bowl of bleached white popcorn over to the counter.
This is now the official snack food of this campaign. Henry, you eat this stuff. You lose weight. It has negative calories. She put her hand on my forearm, kissed my cheek. Have a taste. It smelled like popcorn, but tasted like chewed over paper.
You think he'll go for this? I asked.
He'll go for anything, she said, if you provide it in sufficient quantity. We met in the study. The last time I'd been in that room, it had seemed several years earlier, had been the Sunday night before we went to Los Angeles, the night we found out we were cratering in New Hampshire. The mood was different this time, and so was the room. The furniture had been arranged in a circle, with the governor's armchair in front of the fireplace. This room, like the rest of the mansion, had an unlived-in Ethan Allen showroom feel to it. Quiet, but undistinguished furniture and colors. Very pale yellow walls and baby blue carpeting, dark wood brick front and end tables, a square lime green sofa, leather chairs, brass lamps with dark green shades. Richard was already there. Lucille and Howard Ferguson came in together. Dwayne Forrest, the governor's agribusiness pal, was there. Brad Lieberman, Alan Sporkin, Leon Birnbaum, Lorene Robinson, Ken Spiegelman.
Okay, said the governor, still wearing the yellow shirt and jeans he'd worn to Grace Junction. Let's do it. I have a few announcements, and then I'll turn this thing over to Howard. Actually, that's the first announcement. Howard's now officially our campaign manager. Henry Burton will be his deputy.
That was news to me.
We're in a new phase of this thing now. We need to rethink and retool and reorganize a little bit. Dwayne Forrest will be our campaign chairman, which means he'll watch out for the money. And Ken Spiegelman, you all know Ken, right, has somehow convinced the neocons up at University of Chicago to give him a leave of absence to run issues for us. Okay, Howard?
All right, Howard said. First things first. How we hanging, Dwayne?
Dwayne Forrest was a tall, thin man except for an explosively large stomach. He had a graying crew cut, sharp blue eyes and a beard. He was wearing a tweed jacket, aquamarine chamois shirt, no tie, khakis and Timberland boots. He had the look of a man who dressed and did as he pleased.
Well, bone dry now, but we got some stuff cooking. Now that the campaign's come down home, we'll be doing a series of $25 cocktail parties and $50 platters. You'll be eating chicken and peas most nights the next month, Governor. We got something set for every state capital in the region. A $500 plater in Atlanta, another in Houston, another here in Mammoth Falls. We're working on several big hits in New York, for when that comes around. Meantime, we got some interim cash flow problems, but nothing we can't handle. Our frigs at Briggs County Bank will smooth out the bumps.
Okay, Howard said. Brad?
So
Dorsey Maxwell got us a deal on a plane, a 727, old Southern Airways thing, configured for first class front and rear, Brad Lieberman said. Big logistical question now is, you want the service? My mind wandered as they discussed pros and cons of adding secret service protection. That stuff, the schedule and the money, I couldn't care less about. In fact, that night it was an effort for me to concentrate on things I liked thinking about. What came next tactically and strategically? The road out from New Hampshire. I was wiped, played out. As I looked around the circle, the people who'd been most involved in New Hampshire all seemed in similar shape, lying back, staring at the ceiling, doodling, yawning. Except for Howard Ferguson, who seemed cool, untired, unreadable, immutable. I wondered if he dreaded the next day's business, the visit to Fat Willie's, as much as I did. I wondered how he'd handled it. I'd known him for 6 months, and I didn't know him at all. I found myself wishing I could talk to Daisy about it, ask her advice. I knew she'd be appalled. I was appalled. I found myself wishing, for the first time since I'd signed on with Jack Stanton, that I could be someplace else, off in the Caribbean somewhere with Daisy. Then finally the governor cut off the techie talk. Richard, was there anything useful today?
Hotline says Old Natural Forces is shopping for a guru. May go with Strunk and Wilson. May go with David Adler. In any case, I guess this ain't no classroom exercise anymore.
David Adler, huh? The governor said. He still in business?
He'll work one or two a cycle. No straight party stuff, just guys he likes, moderates. This might be his sort of gig, high profile and quirky. But look, either way, this ain't New Hampshire. We are now free to batter the shit out of Harris, hanging with his own words. Arlen and Daisy already working on some spots.
Governor, this is not rocket science, Arlen Sporkin said. The man has proposed some crazy stuff.
Basic rule of politics, Richard said. There are some issues that are so complicated you never talk about them, because your opponents can distort your position too easy. I suspect Lawrence Harris has raised nearly every last one of those issues. His head is on a platter.
Say Adler took Harris on. How would he play it? The governor asked. He was intrigued by this turn.
High road, inspirational shit, Richard said. A nation in crisis, looking for a different kind of politician. David's made his money. He wants to go out a saint. Anyways, he doesn't need to go low road, not so low as he's running against, you. Right, Leon?
Leon shrugged, embarrassed.
Leon? Susan asked.
You don't want to know, Leon said. Okay, two numbers. Nationally. Among Democrats, is Jack Stanton trustworthy enough to be president? 38% say no.
Well, that's not so bad, Lucille said.
13% say yes, Leon continued. The rest don't know.
The governor, color rising, tried to snag a bowl of popcorn on the floor with his cowboy boot, but knocked it over. He looked down, debating whether to squat down and get it.
Amazing those damn things don't just float up in the air, so little to them. He looked up. Okay, Leon, don't keep us in suspense. What's the other number? On a series of personal qualities, head-to-head against Harris, more thoughtful on the issues, two-thirds haven't got a clue, but the other third, he clobbers you, 24-8. Only 8% of the American public think I'm thoughtful on the issues? Stanton asked, a deep red now. Only 8% of Democrats, Leon said. But your comeback in New Hampshire hasn't really registered yet, and Harris has got problems, too. He's nowhere down here. He's at 3% in Georgia, 6% in North Carolina, 13% in Florida. Approval, that is. Name rec, he's not much more than a third.
So, Richard, you're him. What do you do? Susan asked. Play regional. He's probably got Maine this weekend. Win Massachusetts. Try to establish myself out west. Colorado may not be a bad state for him. Hope to survive Super Tuesday by pulling a Dukakis, picking off enough in South Florida to seem plausible, then pray for a split in Illinois and Michigan.
and nail us in the big states back east, New York and Pennsylvania.
He's not going to play in Illinois or Michigan, Brad Lieberman said. You imagine him selling auto workers on a gas tax? You think he's ever met a black person?
We've got to stop him before that, down here, Richard said.
It's not a question of stopping him, the governor said. It's a question of starting us. I mean, if this is a fair fight, a normal campaign, we can take him out easy. Arlen and Daisy probably got the silver bullet in the can already, am I right?
Arlen nodded, started to speak, but Stanton put up a hand.
Well, that's not our problem. Our problem is the American people think I'm an airhead. Now, Arlen, you tell me how we correct that in 30 seconds.
Issue spots?
Spots are spots, the governor said.
They're like this shitty cardboard popcorn. They don't fill you up. We need to figure out some more basic way to connect.
You could try some speeches, said Ken Spiegelman, his first foray on our turf. You could give a series of speeches, real, thoughtful speeches, lay out the differences with Harris on taxes, foreign policy.
No one would cover them, I said, maybe a little too abruptly.
Actually, it'd be worse than that. The Scorps would ignore the substance and use the fact of the speeches against us, as a failed ploy, part of the horse race. Stanton trying to compete with the intellectual Professor Harris.
Anyway, you're not going to win that cohort, the McNeil-Lair tribe, Leon said, so matter-of-factly that it almost seemed cruel.
Jack and Susan glanced at each other quickly, then both simultaneously stared down at their hands.
You've got some promising grazing land farther down the ed and income scales, and those folks aren't going to respond to elegant policy formulations.
So tell me, the governor asked, how do we move this thing from retail to wholesale? How do we do the stuff we did in the malls and union halls the last few weeks? How do we do that if we're hopping from tarmac to tarmac in a big plane, shut off from the folks by the Secret Service? Except, of course, for the folks we touch up at fundraisers. How do we reach the folks down the ed and income scales, half of whom think I'm just that bozo in the National Flash? How do you do politics in a country that hates politicians? How do we show them who I really am?
No one had a clue.
So, am I a pumpkin? Daisy asked. It was 1 a.m. I was asleep.
Are you asleep?
Sorry.
It's okay.
I can't believe you're back down there, and I'm up here, she said. It's like what happened to Lloyd Bridges when he surfaced too fast at Sea Hunt. My stomach hurts, like someone's wringing it out. My arms and legs hurt, and you're asleep, and pissed at me now because, I mean, after all, don't you have a right to get some sleep?
Don't worry about it. How are you? What's new?
You tell me. Am I a pumpkin?
Huh?
Well, they have this first big post-New Hampshire meeting down at the mansion. Half the known world is there. Arlen is there. Lucille is there. I'm not invited. What gives, Henry?
Nothing. It probably doesn't mean anything.
But I had wondered about it.
Everyone's still a little foggy. Nothing happened at the meeting, except Howard's campaign manager now.
Howard, the furtive cipher? That should straighten things right out. What else happened?
Richard said Harris is probably gonna hire David Adler.
That's old news. Hotline this morning, I heard it was gonna be Paul Chaplin.
Who?
Old labor guy. Used to work for the mine workers, ran a couple of reform campaigns. I think maybe the one where the guy got killed. Works out of Louisville. Guess Harris figured this guy could help with two colors. Blue colors and rednecks. Not a bad move, if he's any good. But this isn't an easy game.
Tell me about it, I yawned.
I'm sorry, Henry, she said, for waking you, and for being paranoid after hours.
No, it's okay. Wish you were here.
I'm thinking about it. Thinking what it's like there right about now. The silence of that place. The river. Your orderly refrigerator.
Your warm little body.
Could be warmer, I said. This is even more pathetic than campaign sex, she said. Phone sex.
Are you doing something I should know about?
No, but I may after I hang up, she said. Night, sweetie. I met Howard the furtive cipher at campaign headquarters in mid-morning. He was in his usual costume,
rumpled gray pinstripe suit, flower tie. He offered a thin, ironic half-smile.
You're not really my deputy, he said immediately. And I'm not really the campaign manager. We do what we always did.
React calmly in the face of utter turmoil?
Another thin smile. Whatever they want us to do, he said. Let's go. You know the way. You drive.
We took his rented white Taurus. I thought about engaging him along the way, but I was too nervous. Howard was, as ever, calm, pale, ultra-energy absorbent. He stowed a battered brown leather briefcase in the back seat. He sat next to me, staring straight ahead. He was a man who never seemed curious, who never fidgeted. It was a fine sunny day, and Fat Willie was outside, taking down the heavy plastic windbreak, preparing his place for spring. He was wearing a fresh white shirt and pants, and a red MF Boosters baseball cap. He started to smile when he saw me, but stopped when he saw that the white man getting out of the car was not Governor Stanton.
Morning, he said, tentatively.
Howard didn't introduce himself. He just stood there. Willie, I said. This is Howard Ferguson. He works with the governor, too.
Willie eyed Howard. Howard nodded, offered a hand, said hello. Well, Willie said finally, what can I do for you?
Howard said nothing. This was going to be awful. Willie, could we sit down and talk a minute, I asked.
Sure enough, he said. Can I get you anything? Coffee?
No thanks, I said. Howard said nothing, but shook his head. No. Willie led us to the picnic tables just to the side of his kitchen trailer shack, an area still protected by the plastic windbreak. He sat down facing us. Howard put his attaché case flat on the table in front of him, clicked it open, took out a yellow legal pad and what looked like court papers, then clicked the case shut and stowed it. Willie watched all this very carefully, which, of course, had been Howard's intention. Intimidation. Willie glanced at me. I gave him nothing back.
Mr. McAllister, the governor is very concerned about this situation with your daughter and the possible damage it might cause to his reputation.
Howard Ferguson began, his voice as small and hard as a bullet. Willie glanced at me. I gave him nothing back. God forgive me.
He wants to see it resolved. He wants paternity to be established, definitely, as soon as possible.
Willie was confused. Was this man saying the governor wanted to admit paternity?
The governor's a... He wants your daughter to have an amniocentesis performed so that paternity can be established.
Howard continued, barging through whatever it was Willie was going to say. There were no wasted words, no wasted movements. This was the way black folks figured white folks did business. No grease, no grace, no emotions. Howard, who came from Midwestern hard sod stock, was the quintessential lipless white man.
A what?
Willie said. He wiped his brow. He looked at me. I stared at the table.
It is a procedure performed at the hospital. Amniotic fluid is drawn from your daughter's womb. Genetic material is analyzed. It can be compared with the governor's blood to determine whether or not he is the father. It is a common enough procedure, Howard said, more casually.
He was talking down to Willie now.
It is used to determine the health of the fetus, and that is why you will say you want it performed, to make sure the baby is healthy. How do you get the fluid?
A needle is inserted through the abdomen, Howard said. Willie didn't quite wince. He wiped his eye.
Don't worry, Mr. McAllister. This is a common procedure, and the governor insists that it will be performed by the very best people available. Your daughter will be treated at Mercy Hospital, which will also ensure confidentiality.
Mercy, huh? Willie said.
Mercy was considered the white folks' hospital.
And the governor wants...
The governor insists, Howard said. There are people, Mr. McAllister, who would like to destroy Governor Stanton. He doesn't believe you are one of them. He believes you are his friend, but he can't allow this. You can't allow this. I am sure your daughter is a fine young person, but she is a child, and children are impressionable. and there has been a lot of news about the governor in recent weeks. She hasn't said a word about this to anyone. Willie shook his head.
I told her, he said. She's a good girl.
Well, I certainly hope so, Howard said. You wouldn't want to jeopardize your relationship with the governor and Mrs. Stanton. The governor wants to do everything possible to help you through this time. The Stantons are prepared to be very generous. This procedure will cost you nothing. The governor is prepared to cover all pre- and postnatal expenses. He will do this because he believes you are his friend. But you must cooperate. We must determine, to everyone's satisfaction, that he is not the father of that child. I am sure you understand his position. Without waiting for a response, Howard pulled up his attaché case, put his phony papers back in it. He stood up, offered William McAllister his card. Please call me at this number, and we will make all the necessary arrangements. Willie nodded. He shook Howard's hand. He didn't shake mine. This time, he didn't even look at me. We pulled away, and I felt dizzy. Howard sighed.
What do you think? He asked.
I don't know. I can't believe she won't tell someone, tell a friend, and then we're fucked, Howard said. Well, maybe not. Say she tells some friends. Say it begins to get around. We can just say it's a copycat cashmere. He laughed, a thin, throaty hee-hee, the bloodless fuck.
There might even be a blowback from it, a sympathy reaction, work in our favor.
They're good people, I said. And if she doesn't tell anyone, doesn't that indicate she's probably making this thing up?
That she's pregnant?
No, about the governor.
You believe that? Howard asked.
I missed a red light and was nearly hit by a truck coming the other way. I pulled over to the side of the road, sick to my stomach. I leaned out the door and vomited. Howard just shook his head. The next few weeks were strange. Amorphous. The metabolism of the campaign changed. There wasn't the intensity of New Hampshire. Our political family was splintered. Richard, Arlen, and Daisy were back in Washington. Brad, Howard, Lucille, and I were in Mammoth Falls. Susan worked her own schedule, and the candidate flew about doing foolish mechanical things. He did a lot of satellite interviews. These would happen around midday in a television studio, inevitably a flat, nondescript building with satellite dishes located in an industrial park. He would sit in a room alone, backlit in mentholated blue. He would have an earpiece and a glass of water. He would have a list of stations and anchor names. WHRC, Charlotte, North Carolina, Richard and Cheryl. WGUL, Charleston, South Carolina, Brody and Kelly. WANB, Anniston, Alabama, Kelly and Chuck. And so on. He would do 10, 12, 17 at a shot, 5 minutes each, always the same. Always the same first question and the same evasion.
Oh, Kelly, I don't think folks really care about that. They're concerned about the economy, about what's going to happen down there in Charleston when the base closes.
They were also concerned about what the government was going to do about crime, about education, about... It was awful. He would rip out the earpiece when it was over and stomp around.
Tell me, Lorraine, he said one day. What was it about America 20 years ago that caused every third woman, white and black, to name her daughter Kelly?
I don't know, Lorraine said. Charlie's Angels? The governor was suffering from severe human contact withdrawal. He would devour every employee and every television station, lingering over their personal stories and their problems, hungry for the sort of campaigning he'd done in New Hampshire. But there was very little of that now. He did 3 states a day, unless it was Florida or Texas, where he did 3 markets a day. The weather was better, it was spring, but he didn't experience it much. He experienced airports and hotel ballrooms and hotel rooms and the plane. The plane was as hermetic an experience as the rest of the campaign, only more intense. He could feel the presence of the traveling scorps in the rear. There was the appearance of interaction. He'd go back once a day, just before takeoff, chat in the aisle, say nothing. Lorraine and her people tried to keep the scorps occupied,
a losing battle since nothing was happening most days, at least nothing they could see or report. It was all fundraising and local organizing and 5-minute non-interviews with local anchors. I was happy, for once, not to be too much a part of this. I traveled with the candidates several days a week, mostly weekends, when the bigger public events, debates, rallies, happened. The rest of the time I spent back in Mammoth Falls, working the phones, doing stuff. I didn't hear anything more from Howard or anyone else about the McAllister situation, and I never asked. I let it slip into the black hole that was Howard Ferguson's portfolio. It was the campaign manager's job to worry about the unspeakable. But I was obsessed by it, pained by it. I'm pretty sure I dreamed about it, horrible dreams that lingered just beyond the edge of my consciousness. I was disgusted by what I had done. I was ashamed. I didn't want to think about what came next. I started running again. Daisy and I agreed to go see Terminator 2 simultaneously in our respective cities. She for a third time, and then talk about it. I was beginning to like action movies. The campaign unfolded much as we expected. We lost Maine, we lost South Dakota. Bart Nielsen won that, even though he'd already dropped out. The next day he endorsed us, and we put him on the plane with Stanton, hoping his prairie integrity would give us a boost in Colorado. We certainly needed one. Harris was all over the air running a spot we called Rocky Mountain Hiya, in which he stood in a mountain meadow wearing a plaid shirt and said, "Hello to you, Colorado. My name is Lawrence Harris and I'm running for president. I'm a college teacher, a former United States senator from New Hampshire, which is a state very much like yours. A beautiful state. A place where people really care about the environment. But a place that's suffering some tough economic times, just like Colorado. I think our government should do something about that. We can invest in the future, invest in environmental technology, create new jobs while building a cleaner future for our children." And again, as in New Hampshire, there was a rush of children into his arms. "And our," he was laughing now, "grandchildren." "Shit, he's a Paul," Richard said on the phone after seeing a dub of the highest spot. "All of a sudden he wants to start spending fucking money on the fucking environment. Is pork a natural force?" "Well, he never said he didn't want to spend money," I said. "He just said he wanted to raise taxes." "Henri, a couple of things about that spot got me worried," Richard said. "Notice how they have him saying college teacher instead of professor? And the way spending money on the environment flows naturally from his natural forces bullshit? This guy, Chaplin, ain't bad." But he still stuck peddling Lawrence Harris. "No one knows who or what Lawrence Harris is," Richard said, "and no one's gonna know. He's gonna be in and out of this state by next Tuesday. All they gonna know is what they see on the tube. He could get up there and say, 'I'm Lawrence Harris, and I used to play professional football,' and no one know any different. Especially since we ain't telling them any different. You can't convince Jack to fire off one of our silver bullets?"
"No, he's positive, negative'll boomerang," I said.
"How about comparative?" Richard said. "Hi, I'm Jack Stanton, and I'm a human being. My opponent is Lawrence Harris, and he has a cork up his ass."
"Forget about it."
"So we're just sitting out there doing fast times at Bronx Science?"
Which was what Richard called our main Colorado spot, which featured Jack Stanton speaking to high school kids and giving a much less convincing version of the speech I'd seen him deliver at the Union Hall in Portsmouth. "No politician can promise you a secure future," he said, sitting on a school desk in a dark suit, a demographically correct display of acne-free teenagers in front of him. "We're going to have to compete hard against the rest of the world for the best jobs. I want you to have a leg up in that competition, and so I'll work overtime to make sure our schools and colleges are second to none. But we're all going to have to work harder."
"It's a fucking reversal of fortune is what it is," Richard said. "Harris is promising pork, we're promising hard times. And you know what? People still think we're the airhead. This ain't making it, Henri."
I knew that. I knew it even better after Harris clobbered us in the Colorado debate the Saturday night before the primary in Denver. It was a strange event. Susan wasn't there. I flew in last minute. There had been no real debate prep. just Stanton and Bart Nielsen putting their heads together with the plane people, Ken Spiegelman, who was flying around with a candidate, keeping the governor's mind occupied, talking issues, and Loreen. None of the political folks were around. I caught up with the candidate just as the debate prep was breaking up, just as he was about to walk through the labyrinthine postmodern series of overhead walkways from the hotel, through some other building, into a generic concrete and cinder block convention center. The debate would be held in a stark, overlit corner of the large, echoey warehouse of a room, empty except for two thin rows of spectators. It didn't feel good, and it was strange to see Charlie Martin still there, waiting when we arrived. I'd almost forgotten about him. He was out of money and out of the news, but still hanging around in the race and on stage. It must have been painful for him. He was extraneous. The story had passed him by. He tried to attack both Harris and us, but no one paid him any attention, especially not after Harris lowered the boom on us. Actually, Stanton walked right into it. He went after Harris playfully, as if he didn't quite take him seriously. You say you want to improve the economy and the environment and invest in the future, and yet you are proposing the stiffest gasoline tax in history? The governor said, with a not very convincing chuckle. How are you going to improve the economy by taking money out of people's pockets? Well, that's a difference between you and me, Governor Stanton, Harris said, insufferable, obnoxious, and lethal. I tell the people how I'm going to pay for the things I want to do. You don't. That's not true, Larry, and you know it, Stanton shouted, suddenly, stupidly, out of control. I've proposed a tax increase for the wealthiest Americans. Which won't raise a quarter of what you'll need to keep all the extravagant promises you've made, Jack, Harris said. You see, folks, this is politics as usual. Larry, for God's sake. This is what the American people are sick and tired of. This man will say just about anything to get elected. The governor maintained his discipline admirably after it was over. He even chatted with Scorps. He did not trash his room. He trashed mine. Fuck all, Henry, he said, barging in about midnight, as I was commiserating with Daisy on the phone. The debate had looked as awful in Washington as in Colorado. Fuck all! We can't get it together to do even a half-assed prep! He pounded his fist on my desk. I can't fucking believe it! He swept the lamp off the desk, knocking it into the television cabinet, smashing the bulb. So what the fuck was I supposed to say? No, Larry, I won't say just about anything to get elected. Just a couple of things I don't quite believe. What was I supposed to fucking say? I don't know, I said. He picked up the desk chair and smashed it down, cracking a leg. Henry, this sucks. He sat down on my bed. What do we do now? Stick to the plan, I said. We'll win down home. The Scorps have already discounted that, he said. It won't mean anything except in delegate count, especially not after tonight. You know half of Washington was watching this damn thing. That's all they do up there, watch C-SPAN. They break up dinner parties, hold the dessert. The hostess says, we'll have baked Alaska in an hour, but first let's watch Stanton and Harris mess each other up. And then they congratulate themselves on how much better they would have done. What did Daisy say? A bunch of nasty things about Lawrence Harris. Great. Just fucking fabulous. He was calmer now. Henry, I think this is the worst it's been. New Hampshire was bad there for a few weeks. But I always felt I could do something about it. I could work, go to the mall, stand out on the street corner, whatever. But you know what? This is one big empty country. You stand on a street corner and the cars whiz by. I don't know how you do politics if you can't see the folks. Don't know if I want to do politics if you can't see the folks. I was born too late. I would have loved torchlight parades, whistle-stop tours, you know? He stood up, thought a moment, sat down again. You think we're going to get a Washington candidate, Larkin? I don't think so, I said. He'd be good, Stanton said. He'd come out, work hard, stay on message. He's clean. He's sterile. Henry, my man, he said, standing again. Sterile is what's happening. Larry's the next thing to sterile. He's smart. He smells of chalk and erasers. You can trust a fella like that. Not so sure you want to vote for him,
He might assign homework, but you can trust him. Good thing he doesn't understand Stanton's third rule. You don't want to go around campaigning for office and acting too smart. Certainly not book smart. The only kind of smart that folks in this country tolerate is country smart. See, if it's just me and Lawrence, I may have a shot. If I can make him look prideful and preachy and cold and pointy-headed. But I can't attack him frontally. I know Richard and all of them are itchy to drop the big one, but it's too damn dangerous given how people think of me. But can you just let him keep on hammering you the way he did tonight? He shook his head as if to say no. Damnedest thing, he said. I watch elections all the time, study them, love them. Usually I can figure out what each guy should do. Doesn't make any difference if they're Democrat or Republican. There's always something. But I can't crack this one. I can't figure it out. Probably just too close to it. That's why you hire hired guns, I guess. He moved toward the door, opened it, then turned. It's also why, I gotta tell you, Henry, if I'm a God-fearing Democrat sitting in Washington tonight, or maybe even someplace else, and I've ever had an itch to be President of the United States, I may be scratching just a little. Two things happened the next Monday that changed Jack Stanton's mind about going negative and set us on the strange path that led to the third candidate he was dreading. The first was a scary Leon poll from Florida. We were ahead, but not convincingly, 35-21, with a lot undecided in Stanton's negatives at 45 and 62% saying they'd like to see another candidate in the race. You know what it looks like, the governor said. It looks like New Hampshire in reverse. If we can't do better in Florida than he did in New Hampshire, we may be mortally fucked. The other thing was that Lawrence Harris, or more likely, Paul Shapley, made a mistake. They went negative on us in Colorado. It was a strange ad. It started with drums and deep horns and pictures of the war in Vietnam, the flag waving, then scruffy protesters marching in the streets. When our country was at war, Jack Stanton just didn't opt out. He used pull to get himself out. A jail door slid open with a rusty squeak. Now our country is facing another crisis. And there was Lawrence Harris back in the damn meadow. It's a silent crisis, a fiscal crisis, an economic crisis. I'll face that crisis. I won't run away. Have you seen it? I asked Richard by phone. Stanton had asked me to stay with him after the debate. We were trying to make sure we held our base in Georgia, which would be voting the same day as Colorado. We were in Macon at one of those rare events the governor actually enjoyed, a town meeting at a local high school. It was probably a waste of time, but I'd argued for it with Lucille, who was now doing scheduling. It's like vitamins, I said. It keeps him pumped the rest of the day. But he wouldn't need the stimulation this day. He knew about the poll and the ad before he started the town meeting, and he seemed to race through the questions from the audience, impatient, on autopilot, giving stock answers instead of locking in on the folks. This was, I realized, how politicians who were not Jack Stanton routinely worked these sort of events. Having caught the drift, I went outside. It was a fabulously warm and bright day, birds were singing, and called Richard. Yeah, I saw the ad. It's completely fucking bizarre. Like they started to do one spot, a slice and dice on us, then suddenly changed their minds. I mean, what are they after here, enviro veterans? It's fucking idiotic. If they wanted to go negative, why didn't they just use that clip from the debate where he lit us up? Because Jack mentioned that Harris wanted to raise taxes right in the middle of it. Maybe, Richard said. But the politics as usual line is dynamite. And then he'll say anything to get elected without a comeback from Jack? Slam fucking dunk. I'd wear that out. I was him. It wouldn't even be perceived as going negative. It's like a fact, you know? It's reality. He's just saying, look at what happened last Saturday night. You know what I mean? It's a no-brainer. But you know what's even more fucked up? Why on earth did they go negative on us in Colorado in the first place? They should have waited, sprung it on us in Florida. Weren't you the one saying Chaplin was so good? No, you were. You liked Rocky Mountain Hiya. He's a Union Jew. I didn't know,
Richard believed there were three basic categories of Democratic Party polls: Bostons, Southerns, and Jews. Chaplin, coming from the mine workers in Louisville, had been intriguing.
I think he's Jewish, Richard said. Chaplin could be anything, right? Shorten Shapiro, maybe?
What difference does it make? I asked.
Know thine enemy, he said.
The Jewish move would be to go negative in Colorado, I said, teasing him.
No, that's just it. The Jewish move would be to be freaked out by cowboys. Be cautious. Drop the big one in Colorado and make sure Stanton doesn't come back and win it. And use a patriotic spot, a flag waver. You gotta love it. You know, it probably has something to do with the mine workers never having much luck organizing out west. At least, not as much as back east. Western labor guys tend to be scary. Anarchists. Wobblies, gun nuts. The guys from Brooklyn go out there to organize. They figure they gotta be wired up.
Richard, that is 98% bullshit, I said. You don't even know if Chaplin's Jewish.
Oh, he's Jewish, and he's fucked up big time. He knows we're fighting with one arm. He knows we ain't gonna go negative first. So I would have held off to Florida, and then clocked us there.
He might do that anyway, I said.
He might, Richard said. But it won't be as elegant. He's lost my fucking respect, and he's given us the opportunity to fight back. I was figuring on having a knockdown drag-out with old Jackie. Get him to whop this shitbird before he whopped us. I was expecting to have to threaten to quit or start exposing myself to muffins again, you know? But that may not be necessary now. Chaplin did our work for us.
Not Chaplin. It's more Leon, I said. Stanton will care more about the poll than that stupid ad.
Probably so, Richard said. Whichever my guess is, our Jackie will be ready to play.
It certainly seems so. Stanton raced out of the town meeting in Macon, back to the plane for a short hop to Atlanta with his game face on.
Call everyone, he said in the car. Get Richard, Leon, and Libby. I want them at the hotel tonight. Tell Libby I want to see every fucking vote Harris cast when he was in the Senate, especially on foreign policy. Tell her to check committee votes on that if she can. I think he was on foreign relations, right? I nodded. And tell Lucille I want to cancel everything but money events in every state but Florida and start working on some new staff there. Radio shows. The old folks listen to a lot of radio. And let's see what Daisy has. Call Daisy. Have her come down, too. Bring her silver bullets.
That should make you happy, Henri.
Tell her to pack a bag. We'll set her up with an edit studio in Miami or maybe Orlando. They've got facilities there now. And it's more in the center of the state. Have Brad figure it out.
He sat back, stared out the window.
We can't build me up, he said quietly. We are going to tear that motherfucker down. I'm going to break his fucking back.
The Florida campaign opened symmetrically. On Tuesday night, Harris celebrated his Colorado victory in Miami, where he was trying to build a base along Condo Row, and we celebrated our Georgia victory up in Tampa, trying to protect our strength among Yellow Dog Democrats in the northern half of the state. On Wednesday, both campaigns moved into enemy turf and unveiled their secret weapons. Harris's was Freddie Picker, which didn't seem such a big deal at first. I remember him vaguely, but fondly. He was one of the new Southerners who'd suddenly materialized in the 1970s, the first politicians elected with both black and white votes south of the Mason-Dixon line. I was a teenager then. My grandfather was a decade dead. My father was several years disappeared, but those pale, bland Southern Democrats seemed a down payment on the family dream. It was a whisper of a revolution. There wasn't much blood or lust to it, just the promise of Northern money, new factories, new branch offices, in return for the appearance of racial harmony. Amazingly, the crackers went for it. It happened so smoothly nobody noticed, but I noticed. I saw Jimmy Carter coming even before the series of speculative articles in the New York Times at the beginning of the 1976 campaign. Could a little-known Southern governor make a name for himself in national politics? That seemed dense. Of course he could, if he managed to get himself elected governor of Georgia with both black and white votes. What couldn't he do? Fred Picker had gotten himself elected governor of Florida around the same time and was speculated upon as well. There had been a Picker for President movement. but it had come and gone, just as he had. I don't remember his being disgraced or defeated, but had he served one term or two? His name never surfaced anymore. I hadn't heard or thought of him in years, until the Thursday before the Florida primary when he suddenly appeared with Lawrence Harris at a Tallahassee press conference.
"I am very proud to announce," Harris said, wearing a seersucker suit that vibrated crazily on television, "that former governor Fred Picker has not only agreed to endorse my candidacy, but will chair my effort here in Florida, and he will remain with me after the primary in a significant advisory capacity. I think most Floridians know that Governor Picker is a man with little tolerance for politics as usual. They will understand what it means when a man of his integrity steps forward." At which point, Freddie Picker stepped forward. He was still trim. In fact, he seemed tauter, more serious than my fuzzy recollection of him as governor. He had a great hawk-like nose and arched eyebrows that seemed playful, ironic. He was wearing a blue blazer and a muted plaid shirt, no tie. He had the look of a man who, after no small struggle, had come to terms with himself, though perhaps just barely. His eyes were sharp, dark. He didn't scan an audience the way most Pauls do, but darted from face to face like a bird. You could sense an edge of wildness in those eyes. He looked out at the assembled scorps, blinked once, and said, "You guys are still ugly." "Governor," asked a television blonde who was not ugly, "what brought you back into politics after all these years?" "Well, electing a president is serious business, but this hasn't been a very serious campaign except for Senator Harris here, and we need to get serious. I think this country needs to get its act together. I was thinking about bringing out my old broom," he said, suppressing a laugh. "You children probably don't remember, but that was how I ran in 74. Time for a clean sweep. But that just doesn't seem technological enough now. Need to keep up with the times. Need a more modern contraption. Maybe a dustbuster." Libby Holden's screech could be heard all the way from Mammoth Falls. It was as if someone had broken our code.
"Governor, what's your opinion of Jack Stanton? You say this hasn't been a serious campaign. Is that his fault?"
Tom Rickman of the Miami Herald asked.
"Well, he does have serious hair."
When the laughter died down, Freddie Picker continued. "Look, I'm sure Governor Stanton is a fine man, but we have an extraordinary man right here, a man who's willing to tell it straight to the American people." He put an arm around Lawrence Harris, who had faded into the background a bit. Indeed, Harris came across in black and white, compared with Picker, who was, ineffably, technicolor.
"Senator Harris, would you consider Governor Picker as a running mate?"
"Well, it's a bit premature to be speculating about that," Harris woofed, chest puffed out. "But Governor Picker certainly is the sort of person you'd see in a Harris administration."
"Not so fast there, Senator. I've only signed on for a week," Picker chided, playfully squeezing the candidate's neck, then turning serious. "But I will be out there, between now and next Tuesday, helping this man every way I can."
Lorene Robinson and I had our heads together, watching this on her transistor television in the lobby outside the cafeteria auditorium at the Mogan David Senior Center in Pompano Beach. My beeper vibrated. It was Daisy.
"You see that?" she asked.
"He's good," I said. "Picker."
"The governor see it?"
"No, he's eating lunch with the Old Testament."
"He's going to be thrilled with that hairline," Daisy said. "You think this guy is going to make any difference down here?"
"Do endorsements ever make a difference?" I asked.
"It half looked like Harris was endorsing Picker," Daisy said. "Someone should tell the professor that seersucker plus TV equals death."
"It looked like a carnival ride. Probably caused mass vertigo outbreaks in half the nursing homes in Broward County. And if Picker is going to have a significant advisory role in the campaign after Florida, how come he'd only said he'd signed on for a week?"
"Who knows," I said. "You care about that?"
"Whenever any candidate who isn't mine comes up with anything that isn't bad, that gets my attention," Daisy said.
"You having fun at Disney World?" I asked.
"Just hanging out, ready to roll," she said. "But I don't know what it is with these guys. You get the feeling they haven't thought it through.
They're still running that stupid Vietnam spot from Colorado, here in Orlando. Saw it last night, just before Letterman. You gotta figure they'll come in with a picker indoor spot now. But what else? Why aren't they up with more? Where's the strategy here?
Well, they don't know what we're doing yet either.
Yeah, and neither do we.
You think our guy is ready to go for it?
Who knows, I said, remembering that he had whiffed on attacking Ozio.
We'll know in a minute. See ya.
The cafeteria auditorium of the Mogan David Senior Center was a profoundly depressing room. A file cabinet for human beings. Cinder block walls painted beige. A high narrow line of crack open windows throwing sharp slants of sunlight across a pea soup linoleum tile floor. There were metal and formica picnic tables in orderly rows. Each had a centerpiece. Israel and American flags. At the front of the room, hanging on a red brick wall, was a dreadful representation of a turquoise and brass menorah topped with an oversized Star of David. Scattered about on the walls were faded Israeli travel posters and sad, shaky amateur artwork. Near the door was a bulletin board with photos of a recent field trip to the dog track and announcements of canasta tournaments, lectures, and singles mix nights to come. It all seemed antiseptic, perfunctory, a depository. But then, we weren't there to spread joy, either. This was not going to be a moment I would cherish. Stanton was sitting at one of the picnic tables, surrounded by extremely old people, eating soggy tuna on white. I found myself wondering if he had extinguished his sandwich in something more than the usual two bites, and hoping that he wasn't poaching off his neighbor's plates. I also found myself giggling at the thought that maybe his lunch companions were so fogbound they wouldn't notice if he made everyone's lunch disappear. I watched him sitting there, with a blue velvet yarmulke precariously atop his head, nodding respectfully, listening, the good son, and suddenly, the whole thing seemed absurd. The idea that we were about to nuke Lawrence Harris here, in front of these demi-oblivious people. He was introduced by a spry fellow named Mort Silberberg, who said that Jack Stanton reminded him of Jack Kennedy. "This boy," he said, "has got the charisma. Believe me, he's got real pizzazz. He's the next president of the United States, Governor Jack Stanton." The governor stood, bobbing his head and spreading his arms, more good son choreography, as if to say, "Well, here I am, and does anybody need anything from the store?" It seemed condescending, transparent, unworthy. I realized that I was in a foul mood, hoping he would actually do something he was supposed to do, but not really wanting to see him do it. This would be politics as usual, Stanton as accused. He seemed tentative. He meandered through his usual stump speech as if distracted, but he was preparing himself for the kill, which came brilliantly, quietly, sadly.
"I want to speak for a moment about my opponent, Senator Harris," he said. "An excellent man, a learned man." Then he paused, shook his head. "But there are some differences between us. I think you should know about them, and quite frankly, I was surprised and disappointed to discover some of his positions on issues of interest to you and me. For example, I agree with him about the importance of reducing the deficit. I think that's very important. But in his eagerness to cut spending, Senator Harris has made some questionable proposals. Look in his booklet, Saving the Future. Look on page 18, third paragraph down. He wants to study a reduction, perhaps even a freeze, in cost of living adjustments for Social Security." There was a rustling in the room, like a breeze passing through a tree, and you could hear the old people whispering to one another, or maybe just to themselves. "Social Security? 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 Yitty, yitty." Stanton measured the breeze, let it pass. "Yeah," he nodded sadly. "I know, and you know, how important it is for your Social Security to keep up with the prices at the grocery store. And you know how prices keep going up. I have this chart, and some of my young people will distribute it to you, showing how prices in South Florida have gone up during the last 10 years, and how your Social Security has just barely kept up with them. I also disagree with Senator Harris about Medicare," Stanton said, which caused another breeze, stiffer this time. He waited for them. "He wants you to pay more,
page 23 in his booklet. Let me read. Part B copayments should be adjusted for income to reflect the program's original intention of a 50-50 split between government and recipient. He also adds, I want to be fair here, the poor should not be affected by these changes. In fact, we should try to alleviate their copayments wherever possible. Now, let me try to explain what this means.
It means we pay more and the Schwarzers pay less,
said an explosively bitter little man in a short-sleeved white shirt, Madras Bermuda shorts and sandals.
No, that's not true, Stanton replied, though not quite vehemently enough to suit my taste. And I believe it's very important that every senior gets all the medical care he or she needs, regardless of race or creed. But what Senator Harris is doing here is opening the door to changes that may have an adverse impact. I don't think we can take that chance. There are other things in the Senator's book. I would recommend that each of you read it carefully before making this very important decision about the future of our country. And read my literature, my issue papers, too, of course, he said, walking a few steps, turning slightly. But there is another area where Senator Harris and I disagree, and that is on foreign policy, specifically the Middle East. There were whispers and shushes throughout the room. Stanton held out his hands, quieted them down. When he was a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, my opponent had to cast a great many votes regarding the security and the future of the State of Israel. No! Shouted a woman wearing sunglasses and shellacked hair of a color that did not occur in nature. Now wait, I agree with many of his votes, Stanton said. But there were some. Well, I think it's important to stand with our friends. And our country has no better friend than the State of Israel. And when we do have a difference of opinion, it should be settled privately. Many of us had mixed feelings about the incursion into Lebanon 10 years ago, but I don't think I would have called Israel the aggressor state, as Senator Harris did. I think we all know who the aggressor really is in that neighborhood. Nor would I have voted for a resolution opposing the construction of new settlements on the West Bank. Like many of you, I may question the wisdom of such settlements, but I am opposed to interfering in the internal affairs of an ally. Unlike my opponent, apparently. And with that, Muffins distributed a list of selected statements and votes Lawrence Harris had made about Israel to the handful of scorps loitering by the door. The scorps didn't even wait for Stanton to finish speaking, but immediately came at me, flushed and righteous with the prospect of having some news to report for a change. Henry, are you guys actually saying Harris is anti-Israel? Bob O'Connell from the Washington Post asked with utter disgust. Absolutely not, I said. Harris has supported Israel, but there are times when his support wavered. And Stanton's support would never waver? Asked Tommy Preston, a black reporter from the Dallas Morning News. Come on, that's not the point, I said. Don't you think it's time we all took a good look at Senator Harris's record? Henry, this is pretty thin stuff, O'Connell said, looking up from the handout. Did he ever vote against giving aid to Israel? Did he ever vote to reduce aid in any way? I let that pass and responded instead to the vile Felicia Alder of the New York Daily News, who sneered, You guys must be scared that Harris is beating you here, pulling this kind of crap. These are the facts, I said. They are documented. We have differences with Senator Harris on a number of issues. Are you saying we shouldn't point out those differences? But Henry, this is... And what about those ads Harris put up in Colorado? The anti-war protesters, the jail door? Is that high-minded? The scorps, satisfied they had picked me clean, rushed off to the lobby, eager to call their bosses. I turned back to the candidate, who had finished speaking and was now in furiously filial mode, awkwardly embracing an elderly woman in a wheelchair while simultaneously looking up and shaking a frail gentleman's hand. Others crowded around and he worked them perfectly, lingering with them, listening, touching, connecting. Twisting around to hug a woman in a walker, he lost his yarmulke. He was about to reach down for it, but a woman with orange hair and absurd breasts that spilled from a peasant blouse got there first. She smiled at him naughtily, then hooked her arm through his and pulled him toward her, nuzzling her chest provocatively against his ribs.
He succumbed to this, smiling goofily and bending down in a half-squat so she could place the yarmulke back on his head, then remaining there as she took his face in her hands, stared at him dreamily, and kissed him full on the lips, leaving a hideous tangerine smear. He smiled at her, lost in all the touching and hugging, then looked over at me and seemed to startle. I realized that I must have been frowning. The next few days were brutal, but very effective. It was almost too easy. Richard had been right. Lawrence Harris had offered us his head on a platter. We went up in every Florida market that night with factual ads about Harris's intentions to raise the gasoline tax, cut Social Security and Medicare, lay waste to the American dream. It was a saturation bombing campaign. You couldn't watch the evening news or any of the top five daytime shows favored by senior citizens without catching a Stanton ad. We did the Middle East number more selectively, with flyers in Condoland and shills calling into radio shows. I am tempted to say that Daisy's ads were classy. Certainly they were elegant, several cuts above the usual Texas chainsaw negative spots politicians tend to favor. An announcer said, "Here are some things Lawrence Harris says he would like to do as president." And in a light, ironic tone, he read passages from Save the Future, always citing page and paragraph numbers. As he read, words appeared on the screen. "We'll raise gas taxes 50 cents. Save the Future, page 7. And we'll cut Social Security, Saving the Future, page 18. These were only the visual images. At the end, there was a picture of Lawrence Harris. Not a mean or ugly or befuddled one, as is the usual practice, but a nice, tweety one. And the announcer said, "The Harris platform, a 50-cent gasoline tax, an attack on Social Security, less money for Medicare. Can we really afford that?" And a Stanton for America slide. Harris responded quickly, though not very effectively, with one of the moldy oldies of political advertising. He stood next to a television set and rolled one of our ads, then froze it with his remote control clicker. "Just look at this," he said, much too hot for television. In fact, there wasn't very much to look at, just the "we'll raise gas tax" slide. "Haven't we had enough of this kind of garbage?" Harris huffed and puffed. "Jack Stanton doesn't want to talk about these issues. He just wants to scare you. Well, I don't think Floridians scare easy, and I'm convinced that you are sick of politics as usual." He said, "you are," instead of "you're." It seemed stiff, cranky. It worked for us. That was on the air by Friday night. We heard about it in Houston, where Stanton was working a $500 a plate picnic for 1,000 Texas Democrats. We scooted out of there, flying back to Orlando at about 10:30 Central Time, a plane full of sleepy, barbecue-stained scorps in tow. We landed in Florida just past 1 in the morning and walked into chaos at the Magic Kingdom West Hotel, where a complex of suites and connecting rooms on the second floor served as our makeshift headquarters. Phones were ringing, muffins hustling, the Xerox machines and faxes churning. Leon, Brad, and Richard were in the outer room of the Stanton suite, working the phones, eating pizza, and listening to a fierce argument in the bedroom. Women arguing. Lucille and Daisy? I looked at Leon, who shrugged eloquently. He didn't know what was going on back there, but he gave me a vigorous thumbs up and said, "Numbers are good. We're holding. He's folding." Brad, talking to Howard Ferguson back in Mammoth Falls, handed me a Condoland flyer. "Lawrence Harris and Israel, the facts." Richard was shouting at someone in Miami, "Of course we want the support of the Latino community. Wait a minute." He covered the phone. "Hey, Henri, you better go give your girlfriend some aid and comfort back there, man." Stanton snagged a cold, congealed slice of pepperoni, peppers, and onions on his way to the bedroom, where Susan was working the phone with a finger stuck in her ear, and Lucille was screaming at Daisy. "We gotta come back at him. We can't let him get away with this." "What we've got is working just fine," Daisy said. "I told you. I told her," she went on, turning to the candidate and me. "We've been moving ever since we went up with it." "Jack, you want to respond to this asshole?" Lucille said, speaking of Harris, but glancing at Daisy.
Show him!
Daisy showed him a tape of the ad. The candidate grunted. Richard came in.
Old Natural Forces learning about life in the kitchen? Looks pretty sweaty to me.
What do you think? Stanton asked him.
I think,
Richard glanced carefully at Daisy,
a campaign this short and intense, an ad doesn't have much shelf life. We gotta come back with something new by Sunday.
We've got inspirational positives in the can, Daisy said. We should close this out on the high road.
I don't know about going positive at this point, Susan said, off the phone.
The theory is, Daisy said, we've no terrorists. We want to give them some reason to come for us.
What are we planning on using? Stanton asked.
You on the desk again, Lucille sneered. Always on the damn desk, healthcare. You think that's gonna fly after this piece of shit?
It's not just the desk, Daisy said, rising to it, truly pissed.
It's crowd shots, excitement, music. You with kids and seniors, people listening, responding.
Henry? Susan asked, and I wondered why she was choosing me to scorch Daisy. A tough call, I said. Anyone have any ideas about what sort of negative ad we might come back with against Harris? Actually, Daisy did, but she didn't know it.
Why don't we just click off his spot?
She scoffed.
Not fucking bad, Richard said. See, the governor could do it casual, funny. Make fun of the shitbird's negative. Do it just the way Harris did. Start off with our spot, reinforce our message in a backhand way. But then you pull back, and it's actually his spot. You show Harris clicking off our spot. Then, surprise, you pull back again, and now it's Stanton clicking off Harris and kind of laughing about how silly this politics business is. You know what I mean? Saying, yeah, I saw this piece of shit, too, and did you notice how this stuck-up dipshit asshole still ain't admitting that he wants to raise the gas tax and cut Social Security? Don't you think it's time to just vote smart, vote for a human being, you know what I mean?
What? What?
Lucille asked, or perhaps said.
Vote smart, Daisy said. Not entirely implausible.
Smart doesn't work, Leon Birnbaum said now, joining the deliberations. I tested it. I tried it a bunch of ways. Nope. Can't do it. People think we're being defensive because the perception of Stanton isn't, smart. Everyone looked at the candidate. He was all business. Susan? He asked.
Too complicated?
Susan asked Daisy.
A click too far?
Maybe, Daisy said, but then,
Leon, this is a big checkers playing state. You test for that?
Seriously? Leon asked. I haven't, but I could check it.
Not seriously, Daisy laughed. But I was just thinking. You know how people always say the loser was playing checkers while the winner was playing chess? Well, maybe we should reverse that. Harris, the intellectual, plays chess. We're down with the folks. We play checkers. And my man, Mr. Jemmings, may have come up with a double jump here. We jump over our negative and his counterattack and land on the other side of the board. Which means we've been kinged. We can go backwards and forwards. We sort of make fun of him. Say, ain't he a stuck-up son of a bitch?
Right, exactly, exactly right, Richard said, bursting. Why the fuck not?
What's going on? Asked Brad Lieberman, just off the phone. Daisy explained it. Well, I've got some bad news, Brad said. If you're gonna do it, you gotta shoot it now. I don't suppose any of you've seen Lucille's Four Market plus a dinner in Nashville schedule for tomorrow. He passed it around. Several people whistled.
Wait a minute, Daisy said. Lucille, you were arguing for cutting another spot. When the fuck did you think we'd be able to shoot it? You don't have 24-hour production capability? Lucille asked.
As a matter of fact, we do, Daisy snapped back.
Then what's the problem?
Sanity. Susan said. Even Jack needs a couple hours of sleep every few days. So, Jack, over to you.
Let's do it, he said. I like it. What the hell?
Okay, Daisy said. Shoot, then sleep, or sleep, then shoot.
Shoot first, he said. I ain't gonna be able to sleep in this madhouse. I'll sleep on the plane.
It'll take an hour or two to script it, set it, rouse the crew, Daisy said.
Okay. 3:45 at Universal, Brad said.
Deal, Stanton said.
Anyone want to play some hearts?
We called the spot Click Click. I don't know if it influenced many voters, but it certainly drove Lawrence Harris around the bend. We had it up by Sunday morning. Everyone in Florida who watched David Brinkley meet the press or CBS Sunday morning saw it. Everyone watching the NCAA basketball tournament that afternoon saw it. It was all over the news that night and the morning shows on Monday. Harris, a jump too slow, was stuck with his first click ad, which seemed prehistoric and self-righteous to anyone who'd seen ours. Leon's post-game analysis showed that the numbers, which started breaking our way on Thursday, kept moving in the right direction through the weekend. Click, click didn't start or stop anything. But then it was hard to say what, if anything, worked in a campaign that came and went so quickly. It may have been nothing more complicated than the fact that we appeared to be confident, playing offensive, and Harris was wobbly on the defensive. It may have been that a stiff, chilly New Hampshire college professor just wasn't going to sell down south, period. No debate was scheduled for Florida, but Harris was desperate to have at us. He made his move Monday afternoon, and a weird move it was. We were driving from Palm Beach to Miami in the Stanton van south, trailed by two buses full of scorps, stopping to shake hands at malls along the way and do radio call-in shows in between. It was a good day, an up day. We were winning. The sun was shining. Stanton was in a good mood. The scorps were lax and happy, taking it easy. After New Hampshire and the weeks of tarmac hopping, the past few days in Florida had been an unexpected blessing for them, a vacation almost. And a nice story besides, with Stanton taking off the gloves and Harris slugging back. There wasn't much news left to report in Florida now, and everyone knew this would be the last day of good weather for a while. We were headed back to Mammoth Falls, then up to Chicago to start Illinois-Michigan week after an evening rally in Miami Beach. And so it was a lazy afternoon. We shook hands at a Winn-Dixie strip mall in Palm Beach, then started south. The first of the radio shows scheduled for the afternoon was the most obscure, but also the most fun. Izzy Rosenblatt's, which was broadcast out of a closet in West Palm. Stanton sat up in the front of the van with a phone, shoes off, sipping a Diet Coke. I listened in on my Walkman. We had arranged for the press buses to broadcast all three shows on their speaker systems, which probably doubled Rosenblatt's usual audience. Izzy, who was 80, had a sense of humor but not much of a following. His show was called Israel Rosenblatt Hour, but he liked to call it Schmooze for Jews. And he kept it light, gossipy. No serious policy stuff for Izzy. Mostly nostalgia and spritz. In fact, what he really wanted to know from Stanton was about Mama and where she liked to go in Vegas, who her favorite acts were, and whether she took another card or stood pat when she was holding 16. Stanton was talking about how her favorite song was Kenny Rogers' The Gambler when Izzy interrupted him and said, "Funny thing, Governor. We've got Senator Harris on the phone. Well, this is an honor." Stanton turned around and looked at me. "Senator," Izzy said, "we were just talking about Governor Stanton's mother and how she loves Vegas. Does your mother have a favorite vacation spot?"
"My mother is dead."
"Oh, I'm sorry."
"And Jack Stanton should be ashamed of the way he's scaring a lot of elderly people down here."
"Scaring?" Izzy said.
"He's telling them that I'm going to cut their Social Security and..."
"Oh, come on, Larry," Stanton interrupted, but calmly, casually.
"It's in your book. It's part of that classroom exercise you were all so fired up huffy about in New Hampshire."
"Jack, you let me..."
"Gentlemen," Izzy said, then laughed. "Hey, folks, it worked."
"Jack," Harris resumed, "everyone knows what you're doing down here, the sleazy politics you're playing."
"Izzy," Stanton said, "okay if I get a word in here? I'd like to ask Senator Harris a question."
"Go ahead, Governor."
"Now, Larry, I'm looking at your campaign book, page 18, paragraph 3.
He wasn't looking at the book. He had memorized the passage, but it sounded good.
"What exactly does it mean when you say you want to study a freeze in cost of living adjustments?"
"That's only one possibility," Harris said. "We might want to rework how COLAs are calculated."
He isn't talking about soft drinks, is he? Stanton said. A COLA is a cost of living adjustment. It means we raise your Social Security to keep up with inflation. Senator Harris doesn't think that's such a good idea.
Now, wait a minute. I didn't say that, Harris said.
Well, what do you mean, Larry? It's right here in your book.
I'm saying it has to be studied, Harris said. Who knows? We might even want to raise COLAs.
Raise them? Stanton asked, feigning surprise. But it says right here you want to study freezing them. Folks, I've told you what I'd do. I won't mess with your Social Security. Senator Harris can't seem to make up his mind.
Jack, that's outrageous.
Larry, you want to go on to Medicare, the Middle East? I'm happy to talk about all your problems.
Izzy wasn't. He wanted his show back.
Senator Harris, do you have a favorite comedian?
This whole campaign is a joke, Harris fumed. It's a clear demonstration of why people are disgusted with politics and politicians. Why it's so hard to have an honest discussion of the issues.
Larry, I'm telling them what my positions are, Stanton said.
You're the one who... You're distorting my positions!
No, Stanton said. You just can't defend your...
Not when you play these games. Folks, we just can't afford to keep spending money like this.
But you said you might want to spend more on COLAs, Stanton said.
Larry, I think you're confused.
But I...
Harris seemed to cough twice.
Excuse me, he said.
He said.
Listen,
he said. Excuse me. And the line went dead.
When the Izzy show was over, Stanton asked,
What happened? Did he hang up or what?
I didn't know.
You think he's okay?
He was on the evening news. We watched it from the hotel suite we'd taken for a couple of hours, getting cleaned up for our last rally in Miami Beach. Richard and Susan had joined us. The four of us would fly to Mammoth Falls in a Beechcraft after the rally. The Scorps would get a last night in Miami and meet us in Chicago on Tuesday.
Well, he looks all right, I said.
That was a noon rally, Stanton said. Look, there's Picker.
Freddie Picker, in a plaid shirt once again, had an arm around Harris, who looked decidedly uncomfortable. Picker seemed tanned, healthy, confident, especially in contrast to poor Harris, who was clearly furious about everything that was happening to him.
When this is over, we should talk to Picker, Stanton said.
I always liked Freddie. Smart guy.
I saw him Saturday night, Richard said. He did warm up for Harris. Big rally at the fairgrounds. He wasn't half bad.
He woke him up, and Harris put him back to sleep again.
You can't do a classroom exercise at a country fair.
He rough on me, Picker? Stanton asked.
Rougher than a bull on a sheep. He's got a responsive chorus going. What does Stanton stand for? He says. You know, Stanton says he wants to do this and this and this, but you can't do it, because there's no money. So you gotta ask yourself, what does Stanton stand for? And so on. It was pretty good theater, gotta say.
What's his story? I asked. Where's he been?
He got elected Watergate year, Stanton said, with some disdain, and quit after one term. He just up and quit.
Why? I asked. Did he screw up?
Not so far as anyone could tell, Richard said. Had a weird scene at a press conference.
What was it? You remember, Governor?
He was going to announce it for a second term, Stanton said. And he surprised everyone. I changed my mind, he said. I'm going home. It was real strange. I don't remember hearing much more about it. I was gearing up for my own run. But you know, everyone thought Freddie was a real deal. It could have just as easily been him as Carter. More easily. He was the governor of Florida. Still looks pretty good, doesn't he?
Looks better. Lost his baby fat, Richard said.
I'll give him a call tomorrow, Stanton said. Congratulate him on the campaign and see what gives.
We did our Miami rally, which went nicely. Stanton spent the ride to the plane on the phone with Leon, who had wall-to-wall good news. We were holding strong throughout the South. I called Daisy with the news.
So what's with Harris? She asked immediately.
He can't be too happy, I said.
No, you didn't hear?
What?
He didn't show for his evening rally in Lauderdale.
No shit, I said.
Hold on a second. Hey, Governor. Harris blew off his Lauderdale rally. Daisy? They say what it was? Well, Pickett was kind of mysterious. He told the crowd Harris was feeling under the weather, but the Scorps nailed him afterwards. He said he wasn't sure. He hadn't seen Harris, but Mrs. Harris said it was a serious case of the flu or maybe food poisoning. It was a massive heart attack. But we didn't find that out until about 9 the next morning. CNN had the ambulance shot and Harris being rushed into a hospital, an oxygen mask over his face. I was back at our headquarters in Mammoth Falls calling around when the news came on. I called Marty Rosales, our Miami guy. 2 heart attacks, he said. A little one after the dust-up with Jack on Izzy's show. He went back to the hotel, had a heart guy come in to see him, and then, kaboom, the big one last night. How big? Anyone know? Well, you know Shirley Herrera? She did some advance for us. Her sister is a nurse over at Lauderdale, and she heard he's in a coma. Shit. CNN just said serious condition. Well, a coma's serious, Marty said. Sit tight, Marty. You hear anything firm, call us at this number. I gave him the number at the mansion, where Richard and I were scheduled to meet with Stanton to work up something for that night in Chicago. And tonight, we'll be at the Palmer House, okay? Richard was jiggling. I was freaked. It seemed cataclysmic, incalculable. You ever had anything like this? I asked. Nope, he said. Dark side of the moon. We were on our way over to the mansion. It was chilly, a mid-March day, sun ducking in and out of fast-moving clouds. Richard was riding shotgun, jiggling his legs with his hands pressed between his thighs, a mildly obscene form of meditation. Usually, he thought out loud, but he wasn't saying anything now. He stared out the window. It was, without a doubt, the strangest moment yet. Richard, speechless. And then it got worse. I was so wrapped up in my own thoughts, trying to play it out, that I didn't quite grasp the significance of what I was seeing in the crescent driveway as we pulled up to the mansion. There was Susan. She was walking with someone. She had her arm around a woman, a large woman. Their heads were down, close together. We pulled up and Susan looked up, her eyes red. The other woman kept moving forward, looking down. She was large and dark, wearing a church hat and a navy blue sailor dress. She looked up at me as I got out of the car, rivulets down her cheeks. Emily McAllister. I just went numb staring at her. They moved on past us and Susan glanced back at me, furious. What the fuck was that? Richard said. Nothing, I said. Henri, I know nothing. That wasn't nothing. Who was that lady? I've seen her. Henri! He grabbed me by the shoulders. What the fuck is going on here? Nothing, Richard, nothing. You've got to trust me on this, please. Richard eyed me. His natural opacity had evaporated. He was right on me. Fuck this shit, he said and walked inside. This campaign is just one long fucking blind date. Stanton was in the study, his head in his hands. He looked up when we walked in. His eyes were red, too. But about what? I didn't want it to happen this way, he said. What? Richard and I just looked at him. He was in his wing chair. He had a blue suit and white shirt on, no tie. He was holding a red and blue striped politician's tie in his left hand. He had selected it, thinking, no doubt, that the American public would see him for this first time that night as the probable Democratic nominee. From the way he was holding it, I could tell that he'd selected it before he'd learned about Lawrence Harris. He had already made the semi-conscious calculation that he would have to go with a less aggressive tie. I knew him so well. Parts of him. It's my fault, he said. What? Richard and I sat down on the lime-green couch. I thought of all the meetings we'd had in this curious, impersonal room, most of them horrible, but none quite so numb and weird as this. It was possible, I realized, that he wasn't yet aware that Emily had come to visit Susan. In fact, it wouldn't be at all surprising. It would be very much in keeping with the mysterious emotional concavity of their bond. The most blatant transgressions often had to be ignored. Damn it, he said, slamming a fist down.
I was so prideful. Henry, you heard me yesterday. I was so smug with him. I could have treated him with more respect, but I was going for the kill. I wanted to humiliate him. You heard that in my voice, didn't you? I didn't need to take it that far. We were going to whip his butt anyway. I could have been gracious, you know. It would have been smarter. We were going to need him down the road. He's a smart guy. And he was right on the damn issues. You know that, right? But he was a pompous son of a bitch, Richard said, and he rubbed your nose in it. I was relieved that we were on this crisis and not the other. Stanton stood, still holding the tie in his left hand.
Yeah, and I rubbed his nose in it right back. But that's not how you win the big ones. You have to be big to win the big ones. And I played it like a fucking county commissioner. Damn it. I wish for once I could just get a clear shot, you know? This was gonna be it, tonight. So what do we do? No, I know what we do. We take it down until we know more about him.
Take it down? I asked him.
I tried to reach her at the hospital, he said, moving on. But she hasn't returned my... Can't blame her, can you?
What about Paul Shapley or Picker? I asked.
You won't try? He asked.
So I tried. I reached Shapley about 4 p.m, just before we got on the plane to Chicago. The governor's really ripped up over this, I said. He wants to convey his sympathy to Mrs. Harris.
Fuck him.
Come on now, Paul.
Come on now yourself, asshole. You think she's got any fucking thing to say to the prick who put her husband on life support?
On life support?
Fuck you, Burton. Some people will rent out their pigment to any old piece of shit that comes along.
He was magnificent that night. He had me go out, kill the music, calm the crowd. I don't remember what I said, but they were stone quiet when he came out with Susan. Both of them looked awful. All the networks, I later learned, broke into their schedule to broadcast this moment.
This is a night for prayer, not politics, Jack Stanton said. We stand here humbled by fate, mindful of God's power, but we must also keep in mind his grace. Tonight our thoughts and prayers are with Lawrence Harris and Martha and their children. We have been competitors this season and sometimes spoke in anger, but always from a base of genuine respect. I think the people of Florida and throughout the South will understand if I forego thanking them for their support this night, forego any talk of victory or defeat, and ask him to join us in a moment of silent prayer.
He kept his head down for considerably more than a moment. When he lifted it, a tear had slid halfway down his cheek. He wiped it and said,
I'm canceling all campaign events until further notice. I hope you understand. And I hope God in his infinite wisdom will soothe and heal and bring comfort to Lawrence Harris and his family.
There was a scattering of applause, but Jack Stanton stopped it by putting his hands out, palms up, then raising his right index finger to his lips.
Shh, he said. Not now.
I was on the phone with Daisy about midnight.
I wish I was there with you, she said.
I wish you were too. I feel just, I don't know. It's like this whole thing just went off a cliff. We're still in midair, falling. Imagine what it would have been like if we'd lost, she said. What do you think happens now?
I have no idea, I said. I'm stumped.
There was a knock at the door.
Someone's at the door, I said.
It's probably him. Better go. I'll call you later.
If it's him, it may be a lot later, she said.
But it wasn't him. It was her. She stood there in the doorway, in bare feet, seeming smaller than usual. She was still wearing the plain navy blue dress and Chanel scarf she'd worn on the podium.
Well, aren't you going to invite me in? She asked curtly.
Of course. She walked in, I closed the door.
You son of a bitch, she said and slapped me across the face. You cruel, heartless son of a bitch! Amniocentesis! She slapped me again. You motherfucker!
She shuddered and suddenly wailed, Oh! And began to sob. She was shuddering and sobbing and she leaned into me, her hands tucked onto my chest, separating us slightly, her head on my left shoulder. I put an arm tentatively around her, patting her back.
She lifted her face, mascara streaked and uncertain, needy for once. She moved her hands out, away, and put her lips on mine. Then she opened her mouth, and I had a decision to make. Oh, shit.